Okay. Well, I've asked Brother Reese to speak to us today. And on your bulletin there, I don't know if you got one or not, but that is not the exact boat that Brother Schell, he didn't send me this picture. He just told me what they're looking for, and this is a boat similar, a Bella Pilot. But he said he's looking for one that holds 68 people, and I don't know. I was thinking of Pastor Jeremy. What did he fit, 40 people in his van in Mexico? But America, it's different. So maybe you can fit 68 people in there, but it looks kind of small. But anyway, pray for them. God bless you, Brother Reese.
All right, we're going to go to Exodus chapter 14 this morning. It's a good thing I went to church on Wednesday, because that's where the Lord gave me this morning's message from something Pastor Austin was mentioning on Wednesday. So it's always a good thing to pay attention in church, especially if you're a preacher. But in Exodus chapter 14, we're going to look through some things here. And this, the thoughts that came to me was from a message that I've preached in a bunch of different places on the past few months during deputation, and I try not to preach the same message everywhere. Don't want to do that to my wife, having to listen to the same thing all the time. And it's not very good preparation for, you know, someday being in one place on mission field, you can't preach the same message to the same people every day or every week. So try to change things up, but the same theme has continued to come up in my Bible study, and preached a different version of this at Needmore a few weeks ago, but got a whole different angle on it as I was studying for this morning. And so we will look here, beginning in Exodus chapter 14 and verse 1. Exodus chapter 14, verse 1 says, "And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, that they turn and encamp before Pihahiroth, between Migdal and the sea, over against Baal Zephon. Before it shall ye encamp by the sea." And I did want to point out down in verse, let's see, I wrote it down here. okay, verse 9, "But the Egyptians pursued after them." Hopefully we know this story, as the children of Israel just left the land of Egypt to go to the promised land. God led them out in a miraculous way through the death of the firstborn as the final of the 10 plagues that just really tore Egypt to pieces. And here, as they've entered in the wilderness, God immediately leads them to this spot where they're between apparently two mountains that they can't get out on either side, and the sea in front of them, and here the Egyptians behind them, so they're boxed in. Verse 9 just emphasizes that fact, "But the Egyptians pursued after them all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them, encamping by the sea beside Pihahiroth before Baal Zephon." So I think God kind of gives those coordinates once again just to emphasize the fact that they are stuck. There's nowhere for them to go. I have been learning how to stay alive in the water a little bit over the past year after almost drowning in Texas. But the sea is not a friendly place for people to stay alive, not for very long. And the army is definitely not going to help. And they're boxed in on the sides. And so, but I wanted to notice in verse 2 that God is the one that specifically sent the children of Israel to this exact location where they had no way out. That was God's perfect plan. And we're going to be talking this morning just about places and ways that God puts us in a position where we have no choices, or at least no choices that we think we'd want to take, and what his purpose is in that. I have an acquaintance that's been just really really burdened for a friend of his, talking about how could God be in charge of everything that's going on and be a good God, because we see all this things happening in the world, people suffering, and there's natural disasters. There's a lot of a lot of negative things that happen in people's lives. And on a good day, when we have everything how we like it, it's nice to just go on blissfully. But this afternoon there's going to be a funeral down in Lafayette, Georgia, for a supporting pastor of ours. And the church has no pastor. There's still people sick in the church and just trying to get through today and tomorrow and next week and figure out what do we do. This is not what we choose. This is not what we'd like to do. But those things happen to each of us at different times in our lives. Certainly happened in my family when my dad passed away. I was 14 years old. I woke up one morning, heard my dad had been in a car accident. Next morning, we were going to the funeral home. There's no choices at that point. What do you do? And so I just want to look at some things about how God leads people into places where they have no way out for his purposes. We could look at Matthew 4:1 and Luke 4:1, but for summary, we'll just flip over to Mark chapter 1, verse 10. These are all three passages about saying that after Jesus was baptized of John in the Jordan River, immediately the Spirit led him into the wilderness. And I was at chapel at Falls Baptist, or at PCM, last year, and Brother Joe Mueller there said, "Don't despise the wilderness. Chances are God's the one that led you there." And we notice in Mark chapter 1, verse 10, "And straightway coming up out of the water, he saw the heavens opened, and the Spirit like a dove descending upon him. And there came a voice from heaven saying, Thou art my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. And immediately the Spirit driveth him into the wilderness. And he was there in the wilderness 40 days, tempted of Satan, and was with the wild beasts, and the angels ministered unto him." So that summarizes all of the other passages that list, what the temptations were and Jesus' response to them. Here it just kind of briefly it gives you an overview. But again, the emphasis being that here it says the Spirit driveth him into the wilderness. And in the other passages, I believe it would tell us he was led of the Spirit. In chapter Luke 4:1, he was led by the Spirit into the wilderness. But I was just thinking about God leading us. And we know in Matthew chapter 6, Jesus taught us to pray and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. But here Jesus was led to a place for the specific purpose of being tempted. That's why God led him out there. How does that figure? I think we'll just kind of mention the verses in the book of James. I hope you'd be familiar. In the book of James, chapter 1, around verse 13, it says, "Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed." And that's not the only place in James where we can read some things in the book of James that might sound contradictory to other parts of the Bible. We think about how in James the Bible says, we see then that Abraham was justified by works and not by faith only. You go to Galatians, the Bible says man is not justified by faith, not by the works of the law. So there's not a contradiction in the Bible, but James might have different different aspect that he emphasizes on. Because we see in Genesis chapter 22, verse 1, it came to pass after these things that God did tempt Abraham. So it said in James, God tempteth, neither tempteth he any man. God does not tempt people. But Genesis 22:1, God did tempt Abraham. And in Bible Institute, Brother Bo, my brother's brother-in-law, or father-in-law, mentioned God never tempted anyone to do evil. He tested him with the intention to, if we think about the word tempt, it has an automatically negative connotation in our minds, but we can think of those cookies that Stacy made the other day. They're very tempting. They draw you in, right? And it's not necessarily bad. It's not a sin to eat a cookie. I hope not, because I ate some. But it's enticing. And when God is tempting Abraham, he's not enticing him to do wrong. He's enticing him to do right, but with a very difficult test. As far as God leading us into testing, into temptation in that sense. We can look at Psalm 66. This has been a very precious passage to me. The year after that my dad died, and then also the year when my older brother passed away, his pastor preached on a passage from the end of Psalm 66. But in Psalm 66, verse 8, this is kind of the theme passage that has come up in all of the messages that I preached along these lines. I really love how God describes the testing that he allows in our lives. And again, keeping in mind the purpose for it. It's not to get us to stumble and fall. But Pastor mentioned on Wednesday the passage in Exodus 15, the next chapter after they come out of the Red Sea, they make it through. It says that there he proved them after the water was bitter and they murmured and they put the tree in the water. God proved them. And also, I don't have the reference, but later I believe in Deuteronomy, the Bible would say that God humbled thee and proved thee and to know what was in thy heart. And so God was testing the children of Israel through difficult circumstances to kind of reveal to themselves what was in their hearts, and also to give each individual the opportunity to choose to trust in God or to turn back from what God had told them to do, just as he gives that choice to every one of us today. In Psalm 66, I would want to read in verse 8, it says, "Oh, bless our God, ye people, and make the voice of his praise to be heard, which holdeth our soul in life and suffereth not our feet to be moved." Okay, so this tells us that God holds us. It reminds me of when we have a brand new infant that's totally helpless to even lift up their head or even express anything that they need. But we hold them and we take care of them. And that's what God does to us. We sometimes feel so self-sufficient. We feel kind of like Charlie or Joshua now. You know, we can walk around a little bit and even grab some food and put it in the mouth. You know, they couldn't do that when they were younger. But they'd find out real fast if they didn't have any care for just a little while. They're not sufficient to take care of themselves. And sometimes we get to feeling that way as adults in life. We got this thing figured out. We'll just make it happen. And then, you know, a year like 2020 or different events can happen that would tell us, you know what, we don't have it all figured out. We are not in control. And God can do that to us just to remind us that he's the one that's holding us. But continue in verse 9. He holds our soul in life. But verse 10, "For thou, O God, hast proved us. Thou hast tried us as silver is tried. Thou broughtest us into the net. Thou laidst affliction upon our loins. Thou hast caused men to ride over our heads. We went through fire and through water, but thou broughtest us out into a wealthy place." Here it tells of all these things that God brought them into. He brought upon them. And even in verse 12, he caused men, probably doing the wrong thing, to cause trouble in their lives. But it was all in God's purpose to bring them into a wealthy place. And that can be difficult. It can be very difficult to see others doing the wrong thing and it affects us negatively, and to trust that that is God doing what is good in his sight. That's a tough thing. And, you know, all of the disadvantages, the suffering, the frustrations we may have had because of the whole COVID pandemic and the whole reaction of the world to it, whether we say, well, it was a natural cause or a lot of it was caused by people making wrong choices, trying to make our lives difficult, the focus here in Psalm 66, he doesn't say, you know, these men that rode over our heads, they're just the worst thing ever and I just can't stand to think about them. He just acknowledges God, that God caused it and that God did it to bring us out into a wealthy place. We need to give God the credit for the bad things that happen in our lives. sounds like the wrong way to put it, but God did it for a good reason. And I've seen that in my life with losing my dad. Not that I wanted to. I wouldn't wish it upon anyone. And I would love to have grown up in my teenage years having my dad around. He was a wonderful, godly man. But I know that God did it for my good, and I appreciate that. And you know, in times of death and shock and change of plans, it's hard to know how things are going to work out, because every plan that we had made, We found this to be true for months after my dad's death. It was like, oh, wait a minute. This would have happened, but dad's not here. So it totally has to be reworked. And, you know, eventually you get to where your new plans didn't include that person that's missing, and the Lord makes it easier to get up and move on. But we think about the children of Israel in this place with the sea in front of them and the mountains on either side and the army behind, and there's no choices. But God brought them there for his purpose to prove them. And we'll, at the end of the lesson, we'll list a couple of specific reasons why God did that. But I just wanted to mention, I had a quote written down in the back of my Bible from my friend Isaiah Carr from Florida. When he was up in New York at Bible Institute, he did a nursing home message that really stood out to me. And I don't remember the passage he was preaching from because I wrote it in the back of my Bible, not next to the verse. But I believe it may have been one of the miracles that Jesus did, perhaps the woman that had the infirmity for 12 years. And that's a long time to be sick and to be probably not be able to run people and to be just a problem in society that people don't know what to do with you because you've got this problem. And for her to have suffered for so long, or even when Jesus stayed in the place where he was longer when he knew that Lazarus was going to die, instead of rushing to make things better, he purposely delayed. And those things were to, Jesus told, I believe it was Martha, said I not unto thee that if thou wouldst believe, thou shouldest see the glory of God? And also the man that was born blind, Jesus said that was for the glory of God. And so we need to come to a place in our lives where we are willing for God to do things that are just simply for his glory. Even if we don't enjoy how it makes us feel, the natural outcome of it. Because God's glory needs to be our number one goal. More than our own personal comfort, more than our convenience. But my friend Isaiah Carr mentioned it that with that message, he said, sometimes God will let you come to a low spot in your life so he can show his power at its fullest. It may be so your life can be a testimony to others of God's power. I was writing down different things we might say, you know, in this, whatever the situation is in your life, saying, you know, if only this detail was different, or if only I could have done something, then I wouldn't be stuck in this situation. If only this person would do what I want them to do, then I wouldn't be stuck here. Or if only there was just some other option. And then I wrote down later, I said, it would take a miracle to get out of this mess. Well, that's probably maybe what God's looking for, to prove that he's the one that's able to get you out, and to show us that he's the one holding our soul in life, that he's the one bringing us into the trial and bringing us out. If we took control and solved all of our own problems, then what would God be doing? Standing back and saying, hello, do you need me? And I pointed out here, would God trust you with his reputation as he did with Job? And we won't turn to the passage, but in Job 1 verse 8 and in 2 verse 3, the Lord comes and talks to the devil saying, have you seen my servant Job? And with the knowledge that at that time God was going to allow the devil to bring incredible pain and hardship into his life, and loss and grief and devastation and his livelihood, his wealth and possessions was all stripped away from him, then his health as well, and his wife kind of lost her in one sense temporarily from even being a comfort to him. And God did that because he knew he could trust Job with his reputation. It was God's reputation that was really the whole thing in question. Job was being used by God and the devil to see how great God was. Would God be able to trust you in your life with his reputation like that? Would he be able to trust you to respond correctly when he brings you into a place like Job where you have no options? What could Job do at that point? He had no resources. He could not undo anything that just happened. But he trusted God and he praised God. And he said, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. And he said, blessed be the name of the Lord. And we think about some of the things that people have done when they have no other options. Things that they never would have chosen. And in some cases, I'm going to mention, these are things that I'm not saying you need to do, that God is trying to get you to do these things. But just trying to get you to think along the lines of when people get desperate, some really unusual things can happen. Now, and not all of these things that I'm going to mention are necessarily miraculous that God brought to pass. But the first one I mentioned, and I'll just touch on this briefly, perhaps you've heard the story before, in Colorado on May 1, 2003, the man was supposed to be on an 8-hour hike. He was nearly back and dislodged a boulder. It fell on his arm, Aaron Ralston, and he ran out of water. A couple days later, he hadn't told anyone where he was going. He was hiking by himself. He ran out of food and water. He, from what I had heard originally, he said he scratched his initials on the rock, letting people know what day he died, and he, you know, kind of passed out. And he woke up. It was 2 days later. He was still alive. His hand was completely dead at this point. It had circulation cut off for days. And he figured, well, I'm still alive. So he used a tourniquet, cut the rest of his arm off, broke the bones, and walked out to get help. Unbelievable that you could cut your own arm off. But when you have no other options, what do you do? And none of us today would just start taking our pocket knife and cannot imagine. But people do strange things when there's no other options. I read a story about Louis Zamperini, a World War II veteran. The book was recommended to me. It was very rough. I wouldn't really recommend it to others, but it was a really amazing story called Unbroken. And he was a bomber pilot. Went down in the Pacific Ocean, and he and a couple of crew members floated in a couple of life rafts on the Pacific Ocean for over 40 days. Eventually, they got to where they were killing wildlife that came out to find them, so that they could stay alive. It was unbelievable, but the Japanese came and saw them floating in the water in this lifeboat, and the Japanese plane circled and started strafing them, shooting. And their life raft, they had two life rafts, they were getting shot full of holes. The one guy was sick in the boat. He was super weak. Louis Zamperini jumped out of the boat to hide under the boat so he wouldn't get shot by the bullets. And while he's underneath the boat, he's having to punch sharks in the nose so they won't eat him. Crazy stuff that you'll do when you don't have any options. And for the rest of the next few days, he was patching holes in the boat, and they survived all the way to be tortured by the Japanese for years, and he made it to the end of the war. It is unbelievable stuff people do when they don't have any options. Also, Ernest Shackleton, maybe you've heard the story of the voyage of the Endurance. They never even made it to Antarctica. Their boat got stuck in the ice, but eventually they turned a lifeboat into a sailing craft. They sailed for days across to Elephant Island with most of the guys still stuck on another island. And they walked over this island that had never been charted before. They had to slide down avalanches and glaciers on their ropes. And the two guys that were with Ernest Shackleton, they were so tired, and they were going to fall asleep. And he knew they were going to freeze to death. So he let them sleep for about 2 minutes. And he woke them up and told them it had been half an hour. And they kept going. And they survived. They went and they got all their men back alive. It's just incredible things that people will do when you don't have any other options. But and so, yes, we've seen in some ways, the capabilities that God's given to man when he doesn't have any options. But like the children of Israel in their spot, there was no heroic act that could be done. in this case. It had to be God's miraculous deliverance. Just a few other Bible stories to kind of help you think along these lines. We think about Esther. She did not want to go in to the king because she was sure she'd be killed, but there were no other options. And in that case, now we're kind of coming to things where not so much heroic or superhuman feats, but just some simple obedience things that had to be done that the people in these stories would rather have not done, except they had no other options. Maybe God would bring us to those places to teach us to obey him. There are things in the Bible, like even as we mentioned with Abraham being told to offer up Isaac, God has asked people to do some very unusual things that don't seem right, don't seem like the right choice. But if there's no other option, then you obey. That doesn't sound right. You don't look for options to get out of obeying. That's not what I'm saying. But when God gives you no other option, then what he's told you to do must be the right thing. We think about the four leprous men in Samaria in 2 Kings chapter 7. They said, why sit we here until we die? If we go into the city, the famine's there, we'll die. If we sit here, we die also. So let's go to the camp of the Syrians. They'll probably kill us, but hey, that's no worse than any of our other options. And God used them to bring a great deliverance. But it was through their time of realizing, hey, we can't keep this to ourselves. We need to think of others, and their obedience to God that saved the city of Samaria at that time. In Hebrews 11, near the end of the chapter, it says, time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak, and I feel the same way this morning. Time would fail me to get through all of this. But many, many things that people did when there was no option but to obey God. And really, we should always feel that if God tells us to do something, there is no other option. I wrote down, mothers go through unbelievable pain, discomfort, weariness, emotional ups and downs, sickness, etc., to bear children, give birth, and take care of their babies because there are no other options. That's the way to get more people in the world. It's not very fun all the time, is it, Stacy? But if there's no other option, mothers are willing to do that because that's what God's given us to do. I guess I wrote this here on my paper. It says missionaries on deputation on the field do very difficult things because there are no other options. Do some strange things with your schedule sometimes, Stacy, when you don't have other options. I'll have to tell you about Puerto Rico sometime, but when you run out of options, you do some strange things. But when God gives you a command, that's your cue that there are no other options. As you find Acts chapter 4, I'll read to you Galatians 1, 15 through 17. You can look for Acts chapter 4. Galatians 1, Paul said, but when it pleased God who separated me from my mother's womb and called me by his grace to reveal his son in me that I might preach him among the heathen, immediately I conferred not with flesh and blood, neither went I up to Jerusalem to them which were apostles before me, but I went into Arabia and returned again unto Damascus. God gave Paul a commission, and it was unusual, and it didn't involve the norm. But Paul said, it wasn't time for me to go check with other people about whether this was the right thing to do. He said, God told me, and I had no other option. I went and obeyed. Acts chapter 4, there's just a whole passage here that we won't read through the whole thing, but Acts chapter 4, looking in verse we'll have to come down to verse 17. That's the only thing we have time for. Acts 4, verse 17, the council has said, they've determined that they don't want the preaching of Jesus Christ coming and messing up their religious system. So they said in Acts 4, 17, but that it spread no further among the people, let us straitly threaten them that they speak henceforth to no man in this name. And they called them and commanded them not to speak at all, nor teach in the name of Jesus. But Peter and John answered and said unto them, whether it be right in the sight of God to hearken unto you more than unto God, judge ye. For we cannot but speak the things which we have seen and heard. I said, we have no other option. God has given us this message to preach, and we're gonna say it. Of course, look in the next chapter, Acts 5 and verse 18. They laid their hands on the apostles and put them in the common prison. But the angel of the Lord by night opened the prison doors and brought them forth and said, "Go, stand and speak in the temple to the people all the words of this life." They knew that the temple is where they got arrested before. Even Paul, in later places in the book of Acts, when there was trouble, he usually went to a different place. But here God told him through this angel, go back to the same place and preach again. And so they obeyed. And of course, look down in verse 29, then Peter in the verse 28, "Did not we straitly command you that ye should not teach in this name?" Verse 29, Peter and the other apostles answered and said, "We ought to obey God rather than men." There was no option to stop preaching. And that's the command that God's given to us. In 1 Corinthians 9:16, Paul said, "For though I preach the gospel, I have nothing to glory of, for necessity is laid upon me. Yea, woe is unto me if I preach not the gospel." We have no other option. That is the command that's been given to us. I think I have just one other thing to note here. If we can turn back to Exodus 14. We'll finish right there. Exodus 14. I just wanted to point out what God's purpose was. I came up with five things. There may be more. In bringing them to this place where they had no other options. And I also wanted to point out in verse 15, Exodus 14, 15, it wasn't just their circumstances that gave them no options, but here God did give them a command as well, which is kind of what we've been looking at. When God gives a command, that is your only option. In Exodus 14, verse 15, the Lord said unto Moses, "Wherefore criest thou unto me? Speak unto the children of Israel that they go forward." Just as the Lord told them when they were going into the land of Israel, you need to go and you need to set your feet down to the flooded river. That's the choice you have. Do it. It doesn't necessarily make human sense, but here God told the children of Israel, you need to go forward into the sea. But I saw some reasons in this chapter for God bringing them to this spot where they had no options. In verses 4 and 17, we note that God is going to get honor upon the Egyptians for his honor, for his testimony among the heathen. That's why he brought the children of Israel to this place. Also in verse 4 and 18, he says it's for the Egyptians to know that God is the Lord. That should be the goal of our lives, for people to know the truth about God. Would we be willing for God to put us in a place that we don't like our options, for others to know that he is God? In 13 and 14, verses 13 and 14, Moses said to the people, "Fear ye not, stand still." Of course, at the end of verse 14, "Ye shall hold your peace." God wanted the children of Israel to learn to give their fears to the Lord. And he taught them that lesson by giving them no place to turn except to him. Also in verses 13 and 14, he wanted the Israelites to see the salvation of the Lord, to learn what God is able to do. We want to see God working in our lives, but would we be willing for that to happen in a place where we're stuck? That's what God wants to do. He's done it many times in history, and we'd see that he would do it again. And of course, in verses 23 through 28, one of God's purposes in bringing them to this crazy spot where they had nowhere to turn, no options, was God was preparing to judge his enemies. And at the end of Revelation chapter 20, it tells about how the devil that deceived them is cast into the lake of fire. And God is going to make a spectacle and display of the devil for being against God and his people for all of time. And that's God's business. It's not ours. We're not going to judge the devil, I'm glad. But God is capable of all these things that we just mentioned. His honor, to show the world that He is the Lord, to teach us to give our fears to Him, for us to learn what He can do, and for Him to do away with His enemies. And when we're stuck in a place that we don't like our options, or we feel like God has told us to do something and it's not our first choice, we need to remember that God's the one that leads us there. And our only option is to go forward and do what He says. I do want to read real quickly as we finish this poem by Annie Johnson Flint. I did see in one source that it said it was copyrighted, but I could not find any information about the copyright, and the lady died in the 1930s, so unless it's been renewed, I'm not sure. But this is Annie Johnson Flint. She wrote, she also wrote a bunch of good hymns. There's many a thorn on the Jesus way. She wrote, He giveth more grace. A lot of hymns, as she was greatly crippled with arthritis, and she lost both her parents and both her adoptive parents at a pretty young age. She knew that life doesn't always go everything like you hope it will. But she wrote a poem here about Exodus 14. I'll try to read this, and I pray that it would help you as it's helped me, thinking about why God brings us into places that we have no choice. Annie Johnson Flint said, "Have you come to the Red Sea place in your life where, in spite of all you can do, there is no way out, there is no way back, there is no other way but through? Then wait on the Lord with a trust serene till the night of your fear is gone. He will send the wind, He will heap the floods, when He says to your soul, 'Go on.'" God told the children of Israel, "Go forward." "And His hand will lead you through, clear through, ere the watery walls roll down. No foe can reach you, no wave can touch, no mightiest sea can drown. The tossing billows may rear their crests, their foam at your feet may break. But over their bed you will walk dry shod in the path that your Lord will make. In the morning watch, neath the lifted cloud, you shall see but the Lord alone. When He leads you on from the place of the sea to a land that you have not known, and your fears shall pass as your foes have passed, He shall be no more afraid. You shall sing His praise in a better place, a place that His hand has made."